A letter to University of Chicago students about what can and can't be said on college campuses has struck a nerve.
From the moment that students come to campus, they should be told that this is a place where everyone is encouraged to engage in the free exchange of ideas. And, you know, with that, you will sometimes be exposed to viewpoints that you find offensive or controversial.
That's university free speech advocate Azar Majeed on the 21st last May. Today, we speak with former University of Chicago provost and current law professor Jeffrey Stone, and we ask, where's the line between free speech and safe spaces? Also, the Illinois Supreme Court's ruling on redrawing legislative districts late last week came down to Democrat versus Republican.
It was a 4-3 vote on straight partisan lines. It appears to be a very partisan split.
How bitter has the partisan divide become in Illinois? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed your weekend. Just after the Illinois legislative session ended in June without a full year budget, Republican Governor Bruce Rauner pointed the finger for the state's problems at Democrats.
The Democrats have spent our state into the toilet for 30 years. We're like a banana republic.
Then earlier this month, Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan had this to say about Governor Rauner and his agenda.
The ideas of reducing wages and the standard of living, hurting the vulnerable in our society, these are all extreme ideas. They have no place in a state like Illinois. There may be other states in the nation where they would welcome things like this. Rauner ought to go there.
We've seen this partisanship play out in the state over the budget on term limits. Last week, it was the push for an amendment to the state constitution that would overhaul the way Illinois legislative maps are drawn. The state Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional on a straight party line vote. Is the partisanship getting worse? Is Illinois any different than other states? Does it matter? On Mondays, we like to spend a few minutes talking politics. Today, we're doing that with Chris Mooney. He directs the Institute for Government and Political Affairs at the University of Illinois. He joins us on the line now from Chicago. Hey, Chris, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla.
Chris, I wanted to start with the Independent Maps Initiative. That decision was late last week. The vote was along partisan lines. And ask, did you see this as a partisan issue?
Well, I mean, in general, redistricting is not a partisan issue. It's not like some kind of social welfare program or some kind of tax program or something that's often does split the parties around the country that way. Redistricting is, in some sense, an issue that's it's more of power shifting. Who's ever in power kind of likes to have it, and who's ever out of power. So, for example, when Barack Obama came and spoke to the General Assembly last spring, he was in favor of redistricting reform because, in fact, redistricting and gerrymandering is to a large extent responsible for some of the gridlock in Congress because the Republicans in several really important states like Pennsylvania, like Virginia, North Carolina, Michigan, Wisconsin, were in control of redistricting after the 2010 census in those states, and they locked in some really pretty egregious political gerrymanders that are going to make it very difficult for the Democrats to win a majority in the House of Representatives anytime before the next redistricting. The reason we think about it maybe as a Democratic versus Republican issue in Illinois, where the Democrats don't want redistricting reform and the Republicans do, it's simply a matter of power. The Democrats have it, the Republicans want it, and so that's it.
Mm-hmm. And obviously that vote was along party lines. We were playing pieces of Governor Rauner and Speaker Madigan, giving people a sense of the tone of the conversation. How much of that do you think has changed over the summer? Would you say that it's gotten, how would you just characterize it?
I don't think it's gotten any better. It's hard to say that, how much worse could it be? It's pretty bad. We are in the middle of a real political death match between the parties in some extent, but I mean, really, this is a Bruce Rauner versus, to some extent, Michael Madigan fight right now. And Bruce, you know, Michael Madigan represents the Democratic Party. He's the chairman of the Democratic Party in the state. Bruce Rauner is not. He's not a. He's not been in a Republican. I mean, he's probably been a Republican his whole life, I would imagine. You know, he hasn't really been an activist in the party. He hasn't been a party worker. He hasn't held other offices. He's basically taken over the Republican Party in the state by winning the gubernatorial primary and then the general election, and by really reinvigorating that party with just ungodly amounts of money, more than the Republicans have seen in many, many years, probably ever. Well, obviously ever, because of inflation. It's basically the governor versus the Democrats in the legislature, and there on that score, I don't think there's been any let up, and I would imagine, given what we're going to be seeing in the next 2 months in various legislative races around the state, it's not going to get any better anytime soon.
Well, and I was wondering about that, because how much do you think national politics plays a role in this? I'm thinking in particular of our sort of national local races, is what I'm going to call this U.S. Senate seat race between Representative Tammy Duckworth, incumbent Senator Mark Kirk, because certainly we've seen sort of the national conversation seep into their campaigns, whether that's Senator Kirk and his relationship with Republican nominee Donald Trump. But in that race, given how tight it is, has also, I think, been widely characterized as being pretty nasty. I wonder how much do you think the national conversation has influenced our state conversation? Or, frankly, do you just think we have enough problems of our own that have made it such a, as you would characterize it, not a great state?
Well, I would never say that Illinois is not a great state.
No, I mean the state of politics, the conversation, not the actuality of it. But thank you for that distinction, Chris.
Right. Yeah, the politics are never super uplifting in the state. I mean, some from time to time they are, but usually it's Illinois politics is pretty. It's nuts and bolts. It's who gets what. It's where you pour the concrete. It's not about great values and principles. And in this case, because there is so much at stake in terms of who gets what, that it's really a death match. Now, in terms of the national politics seeping in, this year is obviously a very weird year on a number of fronts at the national level. And the Republicans have the Republican Party has been taken over by Donald Trump in some ways, like the Republican Party of Illinois is taken over by Bruce Rauner. Obviously, Trump and Rauner are very different people in sort of their approach and their politics. And I would never equate the two. And certainly the governor has done his best to distance himself from the Republican nominee, as has most Illinois Republicans on that level, including, as you mentioned, Senator Kirk. But it seems like the tone of the national debate, the lack of real substantive policy debate, the name calling, the immediately going to the nth degree right away. we're seeing that in the Senate race. Somebody says something and then right away somebody says, this is the worst thing I ever heard.
Sure. And Chris, example, I guess, I think my last question to you is just why do you think all of this matters? If you have a party, if you have theoretically, you have a Democrat control of the state house. You do obviously have a Republican governor, and that's why we've been in the situation we've been in for the past year. What do you think the implications are, or the ramifications are, of this bitter partisan tone, as you've talked about?
Number one is that there's a lot at stake for the citizens of Illinois, or the residents of Illinois. There's a lot of programs that they are accustomed to having that they may not have anymore. Their taxes are probably going to go up And there are, you know, the governance in Illinois really is in a very shaky position at this point. There's a lot, you know, the sort of structure of of state government is there's a lot of things on the line right now. And so how they sort this out, and it matters to everybody. And the sort of bitter partisan death match thing is not promising to come up to with a result that's a compromise that can, you know, work best for the state. And, you know, more generally, in long term, I think the implication for is bad for Illinois politics and the way that people think about politics. And I think this is the same at the national level. People are going to get more, they're going to get more cynical. They don't know who to believe. They think, pox on all your houses. And in a democracy, citizens, voters must have trust and faith in government. And this kind of political rhetoric does not engender that very well.
That's Chris Mooney. He's the director of the Institute for Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, joining us from Chicago. Chris, thanks. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
You too, Nyla. Bye-bye.
A letter from the University of Chicago's Dean of Students last week touched off a debate again about free speech on college campuses and who it affects. Here's a quote from the letter. Our commitment to academic freedom means we do not support so-called trigger warnings. We do not cancel speakers because their topics might prove controversial. And we do not condone the intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own. That's what was in the letter, which has sparked anger among some within the student body and vaulted the University of Chicago into a national debate about free speech. Northwestern University President Morty Shapiro weighed in on all of this with his own op-ed about how he feels about it in the LA Times. We tweeted out a link for you to read that, as well as the U of C letter, if you follow 21st Show, 21ST Show. Today, we want to talk about where the line is between free speech and safe space on college campuses. As always, you're welcome to join our conversation with your questions and comments. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21ST Show. We're joined now by Haley Goldstein. She's the co-director of the University of Chicago Group, Chicago Student Action. Haley, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Haley, what student response been like to the dean's letter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think largely student response has been a lot of disappointment and anger. I know that I am tired, and I think a lot of other young people are tired of this narrative that millennials just want to be coddled and just want safety and comfort, when we know that people are facing real issues that our administration refuses to engage with us on. Like on our campus, a lot of what that looks like is them not paying people a living wage, them not providing adequate accommodations for students with disabilities or with mental health issues, and just a host of other issues that we've been organizing around that the university has just totally refused to engage with us on.
So do you feel like, I wanted to ask before we get into this conversation, how you define a trigger warning? How would you define that?
I would define it as just a warning about material containing anything that could be sort of broadly seen as traumatic or triggering. Obviously, like, different things can be triggering to different people, and I think that's part of why it's difficult to define. But the ways that I've seen it used are generally like trigger warning sexual assault, like trigger warning suicide, you know, sort of big topics that are more likely to be triggering, just giving people a warning that that is in material that's coming up so they know how they want to prepare to engage with it or not engage with it.
Mm-hmm. And so do you feel like this issue of a trigger warning or a safe space should be in the same conversation as freedom of speech?
That's an interesting question. I think it should be, but in a different way. Like, I think the way that the university is trying to frame this is as if people are asking for freedom of speech for others to be curtailed in favor of providing trigger warnings, in favor of creating this space where people don't have to engage with ideas that are dangerous or controversial. And I think that's just not at all what we've seen happening on our campus. I think that people asking for trigger warnings are just asking for material so that they can prepare themselves for how they want to engage with material and how they want to engage with their classes and with events. And I think it can actually provide more of an opportunity for freedom of speech because it allows more people to be included in conversations and to be able to prepare themselves for when they know that they need extra preparation or when they know they need to take a step back for their own mental health.
So you wouldn't see a trigger warning as a limit to free speech or a censoring, it sounds like.
No, I wouldn't. Yeah, I wouldn't see it that way. I think that it's really just another way of providing people with accommodations so that they can decide for themselves how they want to proceed. And I think the university is trying to frame it in this way as like mandating what they can, what kind of information they provide or like what kind of speakers they invite to campus. And I think that's just totally conflating a lot of different ideas about censorship and about freedom of speech, when it's really this pretty simple demand that the university accommodate people by asking, by letting them know what kind of things they're engaging with.
Haley, we have just about 30 seconds left. How would you like the university to be handling this issue?
Well, I think that freedom of speech is something that's important to me, but I would like the university to be actually honoring that in a way that engages with students and with other members of our community who have real issues that they're facing and have tried over and over to engage with the administration on it. Just like for an example of that, the university has brought up this example of saying that they're going to invite anyone they want to campus and that they're not going to like curtail people's demands to not invite them. But I think what that means to me is that that's fine, but that means they also need to respect people's right to protest in response to that, which they haven't done in the past. They instituted a new disciplinary committee to create harsher punishment.
Haley, I'm going to stop you there because we have to take a break, but can you hold on a second and you can finish the thought after a break?
Sure.
Okay, we'll continue this conversation in just a minute on the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about free speech in college campuses, a conversation again started by the University of Chicago last week with a letter from their dean of students. On the line with me is Haley Goldstein. She's co-director of the University of Chicago group, Chicago Student Action. Haley, just before the break, sorry I had to cut you off there. You were talking about what you wanted to see the university do. Do you want to complete that thought?
Sure. I mean, I think more broadly, I want to see the university engaging with the concerns that different student groups and faculty are bringing to them. But also just on this note of freedom of speech, I would like to see the university honoring all means of freedom of speech, especially including protests and peaceful protests, which they have not done in the past. They've taken like intense disciplinary measures. I would just like to see them engaging with people instead of shutting us out and actually honoring free speech when it's in arenas that they might not agree with.
It sounds like you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, you felt like from the tone of the letter, it doesn't seem like the university gets some of student concerns. Would that be an accurate way to characterize what you're thinking?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think just on this note of trigger warnings in particular, this is like a very basic demand of a way that the university can be accommodating students with mental health issues or with disabilities. More broadly, like the university is not providing adequate mental health services or disability accommodations. Their Office of Disability Services has two or three employees who are meant to serve the entire campus, which is thousands of students. And I think that's just one of many examples of the ways that while people have brought up these concerns many times to the administration, they've refused to have meetings with us or students who are affected by it, and they've refused to change those policies. And then on the other hand, they're sending out this letter, which has a frankly very dismissive tone towards people asking for these sorts of basic accommodations. So, yeah, I would definitely say that they don't understand and don't engage with student concerns.
That's Haley Goldstein. She's co-director of the University of Chicago's Student Action. Haley, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
If you want to join our conversation, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. We're joined now by Jeffrey Stone. He's a constitutional law professor. He focuses on free speech. He teaches at the University of Chicago. He's a former dean of the law school, a former provost. And last year, he led the Committee on Freedom of Expression, which reinforced many of the university's principles that we have been talking about. Professor Stone, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
You, as I mentioned, you led that committee. When did you first see this letter that was released last week?
Only after it was released. I saw it, I think, on Facebook somewhere.
Okay. What was your reaction to the letter?
I thought most of it was perfectly fine. I thought that the particular paragraph dealing with the issue of safe spaces and trigger warnings didn't really belong in the substance of the letter, which was about free expression. And it was and these concepts are very ambiguous, so to try to mention them in one short sentence is probably not a very constructive way of doing so, because it leads to confusion, which is exactly what's happened.
Mm-hmm. So I've been asking, I asked Haley this, but I thought I'd ask you how you define trigger warnings or safe spaces. I think a large part of this confusion is also because maybe people have different definitions or people don't understand. So I wanted to ask you how you define trigger warnings.
Well, I mean, the truth is there is no clear definition of either of these terms, and so different people use them in very different ways. But a trigger warning, I think, is basically intended to mean that when a professor is aware that there is material that will be covered either in the readings or in class discussion that might be difficult for students in the class, that the professor should alert students to that possibility so they can prepare themselves to deal with that material.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Jeffrey, I've just been reading through this morning the paper that you all have put out, that sort of the report of the Committee on Freedom of Expression for the University of Chicago. Do you think, according to these principles, does putting or having trigger warnings somehow hamper free speech that happens on a college campus, or somehow hamper academic freedom?
Well, no. I think the statement that we wrote is about free speech on campus and academic freedom. Trigger warnings and safe space are related to those issues, but they're not the same issues. And so we said nothing in that report about either of these issues. But they're relevant in the sense that if you're going to create an environment in which you expect faculty and students and community members to be capable of dealing aggressively and strongly with competing ideas, then you have to create an environment that enables them to do so. And one of the arguments about trigger warnings and safe spaces is that it cuts against that. But the other argument is that it actually enables that, because it helps students prepare themselves to be more assertive and more confident in dealing with these sorts of issues and debates. So I think that there's an overlap between those issues and the free speech issue, but they're quite different issues.
Mm-hmm. And when it almost sounded like, and that sounds a little similar to what Haley was saying when I asked Haley, I know you were listening into that part of the conversation. And I wonder what your reaction is to what Haley said about what students want, how students want to have the right. There was a couple issues there, right? Not just what she was saying about creating trigger warnings, but also having space for students to protest on campus and their perceptions of how they feel the administration has cracked down on protests. I wonder, from someone who's on the faculty side of things, how you see sort of that expression playing out at the University of Chicago on the student side first.
Well, first of all, I should say I thought much of what Haley said was really quite excellent. I do disagree in particular about the protest issue. I think the university is extremely good about allowing student protests. The issues have arisen when students have entered into an event where there is a speaker, and the students, handful of students, whatever, who oppose what the speaker is talking about, then disrupt the event and try to bring it to a close. And in my view, that is not free speech. Under the First Amendment, that is not free speech. That is disruption or obstruction, which is exactly antithetical to free speech. It would be as if a student in a classroom who didn't want to hear the professor talking about a particular subject got up and started screaming and thought, well, I'm doing free speech. Well, that's not free speech. That's the situation where there have been instances both here and around the country where students, I think, have the truly misinformed conception that it's disrupting an event for the purpose of bringing it to a close is free speech. It is not.
And that certainly was the situation, or some people would say that was the situation, at DePaul University in Chicago.
Correct.
Last May.
Correct.
With the speaker that was brought in by the Young Republicans. There were protests. How would you define free speech? I think maybe that's a maybe we should go to there too, right? In terms of where is free speech and where's the line when it impinges, as you said, if someone just stands up and starts shouting when a professor is talking and saying it's my right for free speech, how would you define it?
Well, that's a complicated question. I mean, free speech basically means that you can communicate whatever views you wish and not be suppressed because others don't like what you're saying. That's the core of the meaning of free speech. It's different when there is a rule that provides that no one shall do something that is expressive if it causes disruption. It doesn't matter what you're saying. You simply cannot disrupt other people's expression. And so that rule applies to everybody regardless of whatever their viewpoints happen to be. It just says that you cannot disrupt other people's speech. That's the kind of regulation of speech that's always been permissible. It's like saying you can't use a loudspeaker at 3 o'clock in the morning in a residential community. That's okay. On the other hand, you can't say you can't use a loudspeaker in a residential community to criticize the mayor. That's not okay. And so the essence of free speech is the university will protect the right of students, faculty, community members, to espouse whatever views they think need to be addressed and encourage others who disagree to disagree with them in public discourse, but it does not protect the right to prevent other people from speaking.
And so obviously the University of Chicago has been a strong defender of academic freedom. I think you would agree with that and expression. Do you think the university can still hold on to that while providing quote-unquote safe spaces and trigger warnings?
Well, again, it depends what you mean by these phrases. So a rule that provided, for example, that faculty members must give trigger warnings in all circumstances would seriously impinge on academic freedom.
Does that rule exist at the University of Chicago?
No, absolutely not. And it, I don't know if it exists anywhere in that bald form. On the other hand, to deny faculty members the freedom to use some kind of a trigger warning when they think it appropriate would also deny academic freedom. So, for example, if a student were to come to me and if I were teaching, say, a criminal law class, and a student came to me and said, you know, I was recently the victim of sexual assault. I'm in counseling. I feel, very uncomfortable addressing these issues. Can you let me know when we're about to talk about that so I can just steel myself for this and prepare myself in advance? I would have no problem telling that student. I think that would be perfectly fine. That's a version of a trigger warning. It's very different to say a faculty member must announce to the class in general any time a subject that could be traumatic to any student who might be in the class is to be discussed. And then the question is, well, what does that mean? Does it mean Donald Trump? Does it mean immigration? Does it mean affirmative action? Does it mean abortion? Does it mean religion? There's an endless list of things that conceivably could be upsetting to some student in the class. That, I think, is not a particularly good idea.
We're speaking with Jeffrey Stone. He's a constitutional law professor at the University of Chicago. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. We've actually got a student at University of Chicago on the line who's calling in. Hey, Mary, welcome to the 21st. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I have two comments now based off of what I just heard. So my first comment is based off of what Mr. Stone said about students and protesting and how he called this sort of direct action protest against speakers who say things that offend students, call it destruction or disruption. And I just think that speaks to sort of the issues that I see with the University of Chicago and its claim to support free speech, is that it only seems to sort of see as legitimate a certain kind of free speech, and it's the only free speech that it deems as respectable. And I think that's problematic because I think everyone doesn't have access to that kind of free speech. Because if you take, for example, there was a speaker that I know that I was there when she was just interrupted. Her name is Anita Alvarez, and some organizers came and they interrupted her. And while I don't think that they did anything to harm her free speech, yes, they interrupted her, but I don't think that necessarily takes away from her free speech. They exercise their own by saying that, like, by voicing their own opinions in a platform that they usually wouldn't be given the space to speak at. And so I think, and Anita Alvarez had every option to stay and listen to what they had to say and then respond, but she chose to leave. And so I think that the university, when it claims to defend free speech, it only defends this sort of elite free speech that only certain people have access to, that only certain people take part in.
Yeah.
I don't think it's free speech in all ways. And then, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah, quickly, Mary, if you could make the next point. Thanks.
Yeah, very quickly, in terms of the trigger warnings, I don't think there's any harm in a trigger warning. And I think the confusing part is that it's called it upsetting. And there's something very different about something being upsetting, something being traumatizing and triggering. And I think that's a very important distinction to make when it comes to discussion around trigger warning.
Okay. Thanks for that last distinction, Mary. Professor Stone, certainly we are not asking you to speak for the university administration necessarily. You're a faculty member at the university. But I wonder, to Mary's point about protests, and I guess there's a line here, right? And that's why this is such a gray area. She's saying, I wonder to her point, though, that it seems like it's only disruptive based on who the speaker is and who's defining that person.
It's simply wrong. It's simply wrong. If there is a speaker here who is invited by any part of the university, including all sorts of student organizations, hundreds of different student organizations invite speakers, and that speaker were to say, we need more trigger warnings on campus, or we need safe spaces on campus, and someone interrupted that speaker and tried to disrupt it, the same situation would apply. The same rule would apply. Absolutely.
I want to ask about, I think so much of this comes from a place of people talking about, and it sounds like Mary was alluding to this a little bit, talking about who has privilege or power and who doesn't. And I think given where you sit in this conversation, I wonder what your response is to students saying we need safe spaces or we're trusting trigger warnings to Mary's last point about this is if someone specifically thinks they're going to be invoked and have trauma. It sounds like you're agreeing with her on that point.
My view is that if a faculty member is aware of the fact that a particular student is in that situation, that it would be perfectly reasonable of the faculty member to accommodate the request that the student be alerted. I have no problem with that at all.
How much do you think
that's what I would do personally.
Sure.
Although I have to say, in 40 years of teaching, this never happened.
And I guess, the question is, the counter people might have is, what about for the people who aren't aware and are maybe hurt? And I guess that's probably the broader question, right?
Well, part of it is that's life. I mean, one of the things universities have to do is to prepare our students to be effective citizens in the real world. And the real world is not a safe space. The real world forces you to confront all sorts of things that are difficult, that are problematic, that are challenging, that are traumatic even. And my view is a central responsibility that we have is to send our graduates out there to be capable of dealing effectively with that situation. And shielding them here is a problem in a way because the real world will not shield them. And so, you know, I regard my responsibility as producing graduates who are going to be able to fight back against ideas they find loathsome and stupid and dangerous.
We have about a minute left, Professor Stone. I wonder how much you think last week, this letter, if it detracts or if you think it's good that people are talking about this, all of the work that you did last year with the Freedom of Speech Committee. Where do you fall on that now?
Well, I think it's good that people are always, I always think it's good that people are talking about things that are difficult and challenging and complicated. And these are that. And particularly because there are easy cases and there are hard cases. And what these conversations do is get people to figure out which are which and then to figure out, you know, how they think it should be resolved. And we don't have to agree. That's not the point. It's good that people are discussing these things. And, you know, I have my own views about these issues, but I'm always open to hearing alternative views. And I've changed my mind in various ways over the years. And I hope other people are willing to do the same as they think them through.
Jeffrey Stone is a constitutional law professor at the University of Chicago. He led the Committee on Freedom of Expression, which we will send out a link to that so everyone can read that document as well. Professor Stone, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up on the 21st, we're going to be talking about a new exhibit at the Illinois Holocaust Museum that looks at art created at internment camps during the war. You're listening to the 21st. Stay tuned. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and this is the 21st. The Holocaust was a dark time in world history, but moments of light and perseverance continue to find their way out of that period. The newest exhibit at the Illinois Holocaust Museum in Skokie presents a look inside life at the Gurs internment camp in France. How it is, but how it should be, and imagine life outside Gurs shows a rare piece of Holocaust artwork and poetry. It was written and illustrated by intern Trudel Bezog for a barracks mate, Rosa Hirschbrook, for her Hirschbrook's 65th birthday. Though Bursog died in the U.S. in 2000, the text and illustrations from her book show the daily life in Gurs and capture the will of prisoners to survive and continue to dream of a better life. Joining us today to talk about the exhibit from the Illinois Holocaust Museum are Arielle Weininger. She's the chief curator of collections and exhibits. We're also joined by Jacob Slutsky. He's a curatorial assistant at the museum and worked for months to put together this exhibit. It runs through the museum through May 30th, 2017. They're on the line with us from the museum in Skokie. Arielle, Jacob, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Jacob, I wonder if you could start by telling us how this exhibit came together.
Well, it originally was just about showing the artwork, and the booklet is actually quite small, and we scanned it and we reproduced it on wall-mounted panels, and it looks great. And we wanted to supplement with material on the women involved, right? Both Trudel, the artist, and Rosa, the recipient. And we had information about Rosa because it was the book itself was donated to the museum about 5 or 6 years ago by her grandson, who also lives in the Chicago area. But we could find very little about the artist. So a lot of my research went in, you know, not only to developing a overview of the Vichy camp system, but really delving into the lives of these two women.
Before we get more into the lives of these two women, Arielle, the title of this exhibit comes from the book that Bezog wrote. And when I was reading through it, and it's such a stark book, in a way it reminded me of the movie Life is Beautiful, because it was someone using their imagination to wish for another reality than the present of what they were experiencing, in this case, these two women in this internment camp in Vichy. How would you describe the book?
Yeah, the book itself is as Jacob said, quite a small little book. It can be held in your hand. And on one side, there is the life as it is in the concentration camp. And on the other side is this imagined life. And as you said, there's a lot of humor that the artist put into it during what would have been a very difficult time. The title itself is from the German translation, and it's really wonderful. It was the title that we had sort of come up with by translating it, but then while Jacob worked on the project, we actually, and he can explain more of this, got in touch with the artist's daughter. And Trudel herself had done a translation of the book in the late 90s. And so then what we had taken as, you know, how it is but how it should be, we had a slight variation on it. Once we had actually established that she herself had translated it, we used the title exactly as she had translated it.
Jacob, I wonder if you could jump in and tell us about how you were able to track down Trudel, the artist, her family. How did you do that?
Well, I'll say in the first place, I'm not sure this work could have been accomplished in the time frame we had envisioned without the use of genealogical record repositories like Ancestry and FamilySearch. Those are incredibly helpful because nowadays you can just put in your search terms, whereas before you had to go to all these archives. So I was first able to find a reference to a Gertrude Bezog who had been sent to Gurs via the German Federal Archives database of Holocaust victims, but it didn't say anything about deportation. I'd say roughly a third of the Jewish inmates in Gurs were deported to Auschwitz, including one of Trudel's sisters. Then I managed to find her in November of 1941 on a ship from Lisbon bound for New York, but I had no details on what happened when she got there. I brought in the search and just got frustrated and typed into Google Trudel Bezog Gurs. And I came up with a comment on a book review about the camp by someone with the last name Healy talking about his family member, Trudel Bezog. So then once I searched Trudel Bezog Healy, I found her obituary. And it had mentioned in the obituary that she, among other things, when she came to the U.S., was active in this mountain climbers group called the Adirondack 46ers. and they are still around today. They have a website. I emailed members of the group, and the second or third person turned out to be a family friend, and he put me in touch with Susan, her daughter.
Wow. And so what did you, so can you complete the circle for us and tell us how she was able to leave the camp and come to the U.S.?
Yes, I'd love to. So she had gotten engaged. She had met a student through her brother. He was an American, although he grew up in Austria and Germany.
This was before the war started.
This was in about 35 or 36, I believe. His name was George Healy, and he was studying engineering in Munich, but then I guess he spent some time at the Bezak house in Baden-Baden, which is in southwest Germany. And they got engaged, and then once the war started, he went back to the U.S., and he said he would try to get her passage over as soon as possible. But before he could, at least all the women in the family were deported from southwestern Germany into Vichy, France, in the Wagner-Birkel operation on October 22, 1940. Her brother and father actually were in England on a business trip, and they wound up getting interned as German enemy aliens. But George worked a lot in New York with some of their cousins who were also there, and with a German. He had been the Prince of Württemberg, but he was by then a Benedictine monk and in exile for being an anti-Nazi, Father Odo. So these relatives and Father Odo and George all worked together, eventually securing Trudel passage out of the camp. Right. The important thing to remember is that the Vichy French, they were tacitly aligned with the Nazis, but they really didn't have a stake in Nazi policy. So anyone who could acquire the right documents and pay a fee could get out of the camp.
So she got out of the camp. And what about Rosa Hirschbrook?
So despite the fact that we have more communication with the family, there's sort of a black hole around Rosa's life. We know she was in Gurs with her husband Samuel and two of her siblings. Samuel and her brother both died in the early in 1941, along with about 700 other inmates. Conditions in the camp were, you know, this was just an internment camp, but conditions were terrible. A lot of people had dysentery or typhoid, and you know, there was no heating, and the winter was bad. We know her sister was deported to Auschwitz in the summer of 42 with a lot of other inmates, but we, again, had no information about her leaving the camp. We know she came to the U.S. in 1946, and her previous residence was in a town called Aix-les-Bains, which is near Marseille, which is hundreds of miles from Gurs. Now, we recently got from the family a scrapbook that had a little letter that she had sent to her daughter, who had been living first in Minneapolis and then Chicago. She came over in 39, and we were able to translate some of the handwritten German, and it said, On Sundays, they let us out. Now, this was in 1944, so it sounds like maybe she was in some other camp. But that's really as much as we can piece together. But in 46, she comes here. She moves in with her son-in-law and daughter, and eventually her grandson. And she is active in the group of survivors on the south side of Chicago, and she lives until 1962.
And she saved the book.
Yes, she apparently remembered it fondly and kept it along with a couple letters she had had from a fellow inmate in Gurs.
When you all were able to open the exhibit, I understand you were able to introduce the families to each other?
Yes, it was incredibly gratifying. So we had Susan, the daughter, come in. She came all the way from Oregon. And then Michael, Rosa's grandson, is in the area. So they came together and got to talk about what their family members were like.
Ariel, I wonder if you could weigh in a little bit. Jacob was describing a little bit of this Camp Gurs was an internment camp. I wonder how she was able to, if you could explain a little bit of what the conditions would have been like there in the way that she was able to actually create this book with the artwork with that has, you know, color drawings and how she was able to put this book together.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's interesting to note that not all of these camps are exactly the same during the war period. So in Gurs, they're actually similar to a camp like Theresienstadt. There actually was a fair amount of art making that went on there. We know from Jacob's work with Susan Healy, that she said that her mother actually brought into the internment camp only her art supplies. That's what she used. The one bag that she brought into the camp was full of art supplies. We also know from Susan that there were actually multiple copies of this book that she made. I don't know that the family knows where any of the other copies were or are, and if they if they're still around. It was known that that Trudel tried to, she made these copies of the book, and she tried to use them to better her situation while in the camp. So she would sell them and try and get a little bit of money. So when the museum first made contact with Susan Healy, she immediately knew what we were asking about. She said, oh, is it a booklet called How It Is But How It Should Be? So Trudel clearly either maybe made other editions of it or you know, she made this translation again in the 90s. So the family was very aware that these books existed, but they didn't know that one had survived and was now in our collection.
Ariel, how often is it that, I mean, I don't think we often think about art making during the Holocaust. How much is art part of your exhibitions at the Holocaust Museum?
We, you know, in the recent past, a few years ago, we actually had an incredible art exhibition that was by an artist named Charlotta Solomon, and she did a huge amount of single-page, sort of a imagined biography of her whole family and of the experience they had before the war, during the war, and she took all of those singular artworks and gave them to a non-Jewish friend of hers just before she was arrested and then sent to Auschwitz. That's probably the largest exhibition of artwork that we've had at the museum of art made during the Holocaust. Within our own collection, we don't have a whole lot of it. We do have about 12 artworks that were made in the Theresienstadt camp. We have another small booklet of drawings that were made by someone who also was in the south of France in hiding. And then we do have a few artworks from another, from a Chicago survivor, Eva Katishon-Schieber, who also as a child made drawings when she was in hiding in the former Yugoslavia. But outside of that, we don't in this collection have that much artwork made of the time period. So this booklet is really very unique and precious to the museum.
Well, Ariel, I'm just thinking as more and more people from that era pass away, but as you all continue to have discoveries like this or port more information around what you have had and are able to discover more, how do you think that continues to shape knowledge of the Holocaust?
I think, you know, for us, I think telling a story, showing this object and telling the story really deepens the information that we can give the public about Gurs, about life in Gurs, about how, you know, inmates were, this was a gift given by the barrack on this woman's 65th birthday. So surprises about the fact that, you know, it was a 65-year-old woman who survived and then ended up leaving the camp at some point in time. I think all of these, delving deep into these objects gives us the opportunity to just broaden our own knowledge and the public's knowledge on the, you know, there are so many stories from this time period, and through our objects is a way that we can tell more and more of those stories.
That's Ariel Weininger. She's the Chief Curator of Collections and Exhibitions at the Illinois Holocaust Museum. I want to thank also Jacob Slutsky, a curatorial assistant at the museum, who curated this particular exhibition, How It Is But How It Should Be, Imagine Life Outside of Gurs, runs at the museum through May 30th of 2017. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you so much for having us.
That does it for us today on the 21st. All this week, we're going to be continuing our political theme. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking to Illinois supporters of Donald Trump. On Wednesday, we'll be talking to Illinois supporters of Hillary Clinton and talking about what they want out of their presidential candidate. It's part of a Nation Engaged project we're taking part in for NPR, so stay tuned for the rest of the week for that. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Androids. All of those links, every other way to contact us if you want to give us phone, email, or social media feedback, it's all at our website at www.21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boudou. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.